Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a podcast that I noticed that Frank Turek put out. It's a Q&A type episode, so it should, in theory, be nicely segmented so I won't feel like I'm leaving you hanging if I bail out early, but the main question that he addresses that I'm interested in hearing the answer to is the question of why God created people that he knew would end up going to hell. That has indeed been a bit of a conundrum for me. It seems that if God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and creates us all individually, which I will freely admit are all qualities that the Bible doesn't actually consistently attribute to God, but modern Christians do like them, so I'm assuming they are true, but if those are true, then he could very easily just choose not to create the people who will end up in hell. This does not take free will away from anyone, at least not any more than foreknowledge already would. It would just be God deciding to only create the people that he already knows would freely choose to end up in heaven. Anyway, it's time to see how Frank tackles this question. Let's go!
The first question comes from Dan, who writes in and he says, since God knew before he created man that many would reject him and be destined for their chosen destination of hell, would he not have been better off not creating those people at all?
Well, I guess the only real answer to this question is in that particular phrasing of the question itself. It's not about whether or not we would be better off, it's about whether or not God would be better off. So if God, for whatever reason, needs a certain amount of people to be tortured for all of eternity, then that would be why he creates the people that go there. However, that does kind of throw the idea of a loving God who cares about all of our well-being completely out the window.
Maybe not him, but those people would be better off uncreated anyway? Question mark.
Absolutely, no question. And considering the fact that God is supposed to be all-loving, that means that he should want what is best for us. And I don't think that anyone would argue that an eternity in hell would not be the best thing for anyone.
Whenever you get a question, you want to test or at least identify the assumptions underneath the question.
And in this case, the assumptions are merely that the Christian God has the properties that Christians typically assign to him. Given those properties, he should not want anyone to end up in hell, and he has the ability to just not make people that would end up in hell, ergo he either does not have those properties or does not exist.
It turns out there are several assumptions underneath this question. Notice that a moral standard is assumed in this question.
So you're just going to deflect the question? If you say that we can't know whether or not sending people to hell is morally right unless God exists, then that is effectively you saying that this question has no good answer, because you had to pivot to a question that you think does have a good answer in order to distract from this lack of an answer. Also, morality doesn't even come into play here. This is purely preferential. I prefer not to be tortured. If someone loves me, then the feeling known as love would cause them to want me to get what I prefer, not based on a standard of morality, but based on the feeling of love. If God loves me, then whether or not an absolute standard of morality exists, he would want me to not be tortured, because he knows that I do not want to be tortured.
It's making the case, at least in the question, it's implying that God is somehow immoral if he creates people he knew would go to hell.
I can certainly argue that, yeah, but we don't even need to go there. Whether him torturing people is moral, immoral, or amoral is completely irrelevant here. The fact of the matter is that the existence of hell does not line up with the picture of God that most Christians want us to believe in.
What being would do that? Now, this presupposes a moral standard. It presupposes that it would be wrong to do such a thing.
Well, despite what I just said, I actually do believe that it would be wrong to do such a thing. The moral standard I use is well-being, increasing well-being and minimizing harm. The existence of hell, if anything, doesn't just increase harm, it maximizes harm. Ergo, by my standard, which most people will agree with to some degree or another, Hell is immoral.
Okay, now, if this is coming from an atheist, you might ask the atheist who brings this up, by what moral standard are you claiming that this would be wrong for God to do?
And as I pointed out, this deflection without answering the question basically amounts to an automatic loss of the argument. But to answer the question, by my moral standard, and the moral standard that most people in society generally live by. Even you live by it, Frank. Though you do like to deny it in your unrighteousness and instead claim that you adhere to God's moral standard, all while wearing mixed fabrics and having nice things, two things that are forbidden by the Bible. One in the Old Testament that usually gets dismissed offhandedly as just being part of the set of rules that were just for ancient Israel for some reason, and one laid out by Jesus Christ himself, who says that to be saved, you need to sell everything that you own and follow him.
Most of the time when I'm debating atheists, don't have arguments for their worldview. They just have complaints about the way God is running the universe.
Those are called internal critiques, Frank. That's when we start with the assumption that what you are claiming about God or morality or whatever we're discussing is true, and then show how it is inconsistent with reality or with another claim of yours. So in this case, we can use the definition of love that we've heard a million times at every Christian wedding ceremony and check God's actions of creating people that he knows will end up in hell against that definition of love to see if that is a loving behavior. And we see that it is not. So either that definition of love fails, God is not love, or God does not exist. That is not me using my standard of morality as an argument against God. That is me starting with the assumption that your standard is a real thing that exists, and then using that standard to show that God doesn't exist.
Those are complaints about the way God is running the universe. But it's not a positive case that atheism is true.
So, do you guys remember back a couple minutes ago when the question was, why does God create people that he knows will go to hell? How is criticizing the practice of atheists using internal critiques answering that question? Did you maybe stop to consider the possibility that the person asking this question is not an atheist, but is instead a Christian who is wrestling with the subject and so wants an answer that doesn't end up with God being a moral monster by the Christian standard? If that is the case, then do you think your deflection will serve to strengthen their faith in God, or will it cause them to realize that there really isn't a good answer to this question? Because I can tell you, as someone who used to struggle with questions just like this, the answer that you are giving now would have made my struggles much worse.
You say, well, how could you make a positive case that atheism is true? Isn't atheism just a lack of belief? We've covered this on this program before.
It is a lack of belief until such a time as someone defines God in a testable way. Should that God fail the existence test, then at least with regards to that God, atheism does become a positive claim. I have yet to see a God that isn't either completely untestable, and so is indistinguishable from a God that just doesn't exist in the first place, or a God that doesn't fail the test.
No, it's not a lack of belief. It's the positive belief that no God exists and that certain realities can be explained without any reference to a deity. Like somehow the universe can be explained without reference to a deity.
Now, my question here would be, what do you accomplish by insisting that someone who calls himself an atheist isn't really an atheist unless they agree to that specific definition? Do you think that you will win them over to your God somehow with that? What is the point of the definition fight over the word atheism? I do not believe that any gods exist. I use the word atheist to describe that position, as do many others. Not every definition has to fit nicely into a formal philosophical category. It can just be a word that is used colloquially. Now, if we're talking about a formal debate about the question of whether or not a god exists, then yeah, the definition becomes relevant, and the best way to have a productive discussion there would be to ask the person you are having the discussion with how they define the word that they are using to label themselves, and then proceed from there. If you attempt to fight them on their definition because you think that technically they should be using the word agnostic rather than the word atheist, let's say that hypothetically you win and they change their mind. Great. Now, what have you accomplished with regards to the discussion of whether or not a god exists? Abso-fucking-lutely nothing. So fuck off with your definition fight and just answer the goddamn question that you were originally asked.
Atheists come up with all sorts of explanations they think that can fill the causal gap that they have.
Didn't you just complain earlier that atheists don't have any positions that they argue for in their favor? They just try to tear down the Christian position?
Now here you are clearly stating that we have all sorts of explanations for things. Pick a lane, buddy.
That, oh, maybe the universe is a result of a quantum fluctuation in the quantum vacuum. Of course, they can't explain where the quantum vacuum came from. Or life got here by some sort of non-intelligent process.
The question was about God making people that go to hell. I just thought it would be helpful to remind you here, because I'm really not sure of the relevance of the origin of life, the universe, and everything.
If you're going to say that God is somehow immoral for creating people that he knows will go to hell.
I'm not going to say that. I could, but I'm not going to. What I'm saying here is that he is unloving for doing that based on the Bible's definition of love.
You have to have a standard, number one. Number two, you're assuming that going to hell is somehow unjust and that people who go to hell get more punishment than they deserve.
Okay, first off, we have the problem of hell being an infinite punishment for finite crimes. Nobody could do anything that would justify an eternity of torture as retribution. But second, God is supposed to love these people that he sends to hell. Even if they earned it, if he loved them, it would still be better for them to have never existed, and the Bible pretty explicitly lays out that it is better to have never been born than to live and die.
Well, why do you think that's true? Well, it's eternal punishment, Frank. Isn't it wrong to have eternal punishment for a temporal sin? Well, it depends on what you mean by that.
What could we mean by that other than exactly what that says? Any immorality we display during our lifetime is temporally restricted, even if we include all of the downstream consequences. If a person has such a negative impact on humanity that it reverberates down through time until the sun finally expands and engulfs the earth, well, then, eventually, the sun will expand and engulf the earth, humanity will be no more, and that person's impact has ended. So, even if we could say that anyone ought to be tortured after they die, there should still be limits based on what exactly they did that earned them that punishment.
I guess here's a couple of questions you might want to ask. Does the length of the punishment have to be congruent with the length of the time it took to commit the crime?
No, it should be dependent on the impact that the crime had. That's how our legal system works. If you kill someone in 30 seconds, you can expect to spend significantly more than 30 seconds in prison, because we recognize that the impact that crime had is significant enough to warrant a harsher punishment than, say, being caught with a bit of marijuana. Wait, no, I forgot the justice system is royally fucked up, so the punishment should be harsher for murder than for having pot, but the current system is set up in a way that sometimes it isn't. In the States, anyway. It's legal in Canada, though we're still kind of fucked up. Less than 500 marijuana-related pardons have been granted since marijuana was legalized, as of October, out of an estimated 10,000 people that are eligible for pardon. But how messed up the justice system is a whole other topic. My point is, how long it takes to commit a crime is irrelevant. The relevant portion of the crime is, or rather should be, how much of an impact the crime had on people's lives.
For example, if it takes you 2 seconds to murder someone, should you only serve a sentence that is 2 seconds long? Well, no, obviously not.
Okay, Frank agrees with me. Let's see how long this lasts.
Spoiler, it's basically a few seconds.
The sentence is quite often much longer, usually always longer, than the length of the time it took you to commit the crime. And a crime against an infinite being, an unending being, might require an unending punishment.
No, Frank. It would actually be pretty much the exact opposite. If we determine the punishment for a crime based on how severe the impact of the crime actually was, then if a crime were committed against an infinite being who is all-powerful and thus cannot actually be harmed, then the impact of a crime against said being is effectively zero, meaning that an appropriate punishment would be nothing.
Not only that, but who says you stop sinning when you're in hell?
Well, if continuing to sin while in hell means that your punishment gets extended, then by that logic, accepting Jesus as your Lord and Savior when you're in hell should mean that you get exonerated and get to go to heaven at that point. And it seems to me like death is a rather arbitrary cutoff point for salvation anyway, if we're actually eternal beings. Why can't there be salvation after death? I've never heard a good explanation for that. But again, this is your periodic reminder that the question was, why does God create people who he knows will end up in hell in the first place? Not, why is hell eternal?
You're continually against God. As Jesus said, this is a place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, which implies that you're still in rebellion against God.
How does that imply that? Watch a Christian movie sometime. The come to Jesus moment is pretty much always accompanied by a bunch of weeping.
Please come into my life, and I will follow you as my Lord and Savior.
Amen.
I deserve hell. I deserve it because I crucified Jesus so many times in my life. I did. I realize now.
Can't you see that you need him? Can't you see that you need his forgiveness? Yes.
So weeping does not automatically mean rebellion against God. It could just mean sad or in lots of pain, like somebody's torturing me. And I always thought that the gnashing of teeth part was, again, referring to the torture. When you're in intense pain, you gnash your teeth. That happens. That's a real thing. Why would these things that are associated with being in pain be about rebelling against God rather than being in pain? Seems like a bit of a stretch, if you ask me.
So the sins that you commit while you're here on earth continue in eternity, it seems, which might be the reason why the punishment continues.
How does that make any sense? You said we continue to sin while in hell, but now you're switching it to the things we do on earth are continuing in hell? So if I watch porn now, that continues for eternity in hell, I get to watch porn for all of eternity? Honestly, that sounds better than heaven at this point.
Regardless of any of that, since God is the very standard of justice, it would be impossible for him to be unjust in the afterlife.
Why does God get to be the standard of justice? How did we determine that? This is the Euthyphro Dilemma, but for justice instead of morality. Just to recap, the modern iteration of the Euthyphro Dilemma is generally put as the question of whether something is good because God loves it, or does God love the thing because it is good? So just replace goodness with justice and we get the same thing here. Why does God doing it automatically make it just? Why does God get to be the ultimate standard of justice? I have yet to see an answer to this question, as it relates to goodness or justice, that doesn't just amount to, essentially, might makes right. God is the creator, so he gets to enforce his moral code and justice onto us by virtue of his power over us as the creation. Sure, they'll dress it up in sophistry and claim that God's nature is the source of goodness or justice rather than it just being God's opinion, but that still fails to answer why, when there is a disagreement between me and God, God's side just automatically wins just by virtue of the fact that he is God. It just takes all thought out of it. You don't think it's just or good? Nah, just don't worry about it. If God did it, then it has to be just and good. I'd prefer a system of justice that has more thought put into it than that, thank you very much.
But whatever those two destinations are, we know in one case, heaven, it will be grace, and in another case, hell, it will be justice.
Well, that actually brings up another point. Grace, in this instance, is the suspension of justice. In the Christian analogy, it's literally a judge finding someone that he knows to be guilty, not guilty, because they're a friend of his kid. If a judge did that here, they would likely be impeached. God's version of justice is literally a fantastic example of corruption in the justice system. Also, I'll take this moment to point out something for you to keep in mind when you're seeing apologists at work. Notice that anytime they're using a courtroom analogy to explain how Jesus saves you, it's with regards to paying a monetary fine. So yeah, if you get fined or something, the courts don't care where the money comes from as long as the fine gets paid. But when explaining why you deserve hell, suddenly it's no longer monetary, it's murder. Does the analogy work the other way? If I murder someone and then an innocent third party agrees to go to prison instead of me, would the court be okay with that? Would the family of the victim be okay with that? Would that be justice of any kind? Because according to your analogies, that is the kind of justice that God doles out. So if we're analogizing God to a judge, he's an incredibly corrupt one. By what standard? By the judicial standards of most developed countries.
And that justice, by definition, since God is just, will be perfectly just.
And if you disagree, that's because you just aren't using God as the standard. So I ask again, why does God get to be the standard? What makes him the standard of justice? Why does something that is egregiously corrupt for humans get a pass for God? Why do humans hold their judges to a higher standard of justice than what God uses for himself?
nobody will get more or less punishment than they deserve.
The fact that you think that everybody deserves an eternity of horrendous torture for the crime of not being buddies with the judge's kid is, quite frankly, a little frightening.
A number of questions, and we're diving into the first question. Basically, the question is, why does God create people he knew would go to hell? We've already pointed out there's a couple of assumptions underneath this question.
Not really. You ignored the fact that the question is usually presented as an internal critique, and then went off on a bunch of tangents about the origin of the universe and made a pretty basic version of the moral argument, but we're 12 minutes in so far and you haven't even come close to addressing the question itself. Hopefully, that's where we go now.
Also, another assumption that people make when they say this is they assume that God can create free creatures who will always do what he wants.
No, that is absolutely not an assumption in this question. The question is not, why doesn't God make people behave in a way that he wants them to behave? The question is, since God knows everything that everybody will ever do, and he is also responsible for making everybody, could he not just avoid making the people that he knows will not end up in heaven? If I grant the idea that God could know every future action that everyone will ever take without it somehow violating free will, then this does not actually remove free will. It's just God only making the people that will freely choose to worship him. If him not making people that will end up in hell somehow violates the free will of those that will end up in heaven, then what does that say about free will as a whole?
In other words, when you say, why does God create people he knew would go to hell, you're almost saying, well, why doesn't God just create people who all go to heaven?
That's literally exactly what it's saying. God can use his foreknowledge to not make beings that he knows he'll be torturing, and only make the ones that will end up in paradise with him. That would be the loving thing for someone in God's position to do.
Well, if he could, he would. But if they're going to be free creatures, in other words, they have the capacity to love, and that's why he gives us freedom, they can also have the capacity to hate or to reject.
Okay, so Frank's answer to the question is to just completely miss the point of the question. Great.
So it might be logically possible that God can create everybody who does believe, but it might not be actually achievable with free creatures.
So Frank's solution after missing the point of the question is to then place limits on God's abilities? This seems to be saying that God does not know when he makes people whether or not they will, in the end, freely choose to worship him, because apparently such foreknowledge would violate free will. But I'm sure you'll find Frank arguing in other places that God's foreknowledge is perfectly compatible with free will. Like here, for instance.
One Sunday you're away from the TV, but you record the games that you want to watch later. And let's suppose you're coming home that night and your friend texts you all the scores and you go, I didn't want to know the scores, but you know them now. And so you get home and you elect to watch one of the games. You already know what the score is going to turn out to be. Question, does that mean the players on the field don't have free will because you know the outcome?
I know.
Okay, they're still freely doing what they're doing on the field.
The problem is they've already done it.
They've already done it. And God's outside of time, so from his perspective, everything has already happened, even though it hasn't on our perspective, because we're in time, he's outside of time. So God knows the end from the beginning. That's how he can do prophecy, obviously. He's all-knowing as well. And just because it's already happened in his mind doesn't mean that he's causing us to do it directly. We still have free will.
Now, the problem with the football analogy in that is that for the analogy to hold, the person watching the game also has to be responsible for having created all of the players, knowing in advance which ones will have an impact on the final score of the game. He also has the ability to tweak certain characteristics about the players, giving them more or less natural physical ability, giving them a temperament that would be more or less likely to excel at football, etc. If God were just a disinterested viewer and already knew what was happening but had no hand in creating any of it, then I could see that analogy working, but in your world, God created everything knowing exactly what the outcome of his creative acts would be. So if God choosing not to create people that will end up in hell somehow violates the free will of those that go to heaven, then really every time God decides to create someone, or to not create someone, he is violating the free will of that person and every person that person will ever interact with. You can't have it both ways here, Frank.
It might be that You know, after God creates a few people, the third or fourth one is definitely going to sin. Is therefore then God obligated to not create anything because some people freely decide not to follow him?
Yes, actually. If it is impossible for God to avoid creating people that will be tortured for eternity, and God loves the people that will be tortured for eternity, then the best course of action would be for God to not create anybody. Well, that would be the most loving course of action, at least. Maybe not the best for God, because God wants the entertainment value of seeing people tortured or something.
That doesn't appear to me that God is obligated not to create because some reject God.
Well, I guess not, but what does that say about God's love? At a minimum, it says that this is the love of an abuser. Love me or else. You don't love me, you're going to be tortured. Don't blame me for the torture. I gave you the choice of loving me. It's just gross.
People say, well, God is all-powerful. Yes, he's all-powerful to do what is logically possible, but he's not all-powerful to do illogical things because logic is grounded in his nature and he can't contradict his nature.
Setting aside the fact that you literally said earlier that it is logically possible?
It might be logically possible that God can create everybody who does believe, but it might not be actually achievable with free creatures.
His nature is itself a logical impossibility. Premise 1. God is a loving God. Premise 2, a loving God would not create creatures that he knows will end up in eternal torture. Premise 3, God creates creatures that he knows will end up in eternal torture. Conclusion, God is not a loving God. As far as I can tell, this is an argument that is both valid and sound, unless you put limits on God's abilities, like his knowledge. If he doesn't know in advance who will end up in heaven or hell, then premise 2 does fail. But you claim that he does, so it holds.
He can't lie. He can't go out of existence.
The Bible literally says that God does lie on a number of occasions. Now, sure, for some of these, you could argue that it's not God doing the lying. He's sending a spirit that does his lying for him. But I would argue that lying by proxy is still lying. If I tell one of my kids to lie to one of my other kids, who is ultimately responsible for that lie? Me, obviously. So how is God sending a lying spirit any different than God just lying himself? Also, at least a few of the verses do have God doing the lying himself. I, the Lord, have deceived that prophet. That doesn't really leave much room for interpretation there.
And he can't create free creatures whom he forces to do what he wants.
No, but again, since he already knows all of the choices that they will freely make in their lifetime, and since he makes all of them himself, he could just create the ones who will make the choices that he approves of. That doesn't violate free will any more than his foreknowledge already does.
In other words, our free choice to follow him or not follow him. He knows what we're going to do, but he's not forcing us to do it.
By choosing to make the people whose choices he already knows, he is effectively making their choices for them, because there are an infinite number of possible other people that he could make for any given pregnancy, all of whom would make slightly different choices in the same situations. So every decision he makes during the creative process while he is making a person is effectively making that person's decisions for them. And if you can somehow square this with that person still having free will, then God still has an infinite pool of potential people that he could choose to make for any particular pregnancy, and he knows which ones will freely choose him and which will not. Side note, pool of potential people for a particular pregnancy is a fun thing to say. Go ahead, give it a try.
He knows everything, even before we do it, but that doesn't mean he's causing us to do it, as I've pointed out on this program several times before.
Yes, it absolutely does mean that, because you have him knowing everything we will ever do in advance, and also have him as the creator who could have made an infinite number of alternate universes in which different decisions were made by the inhabitants of that universe based on different decisions that God made during the creation process. Even if we don't credit God with each individual baby, he still could have made the universe in a way that people would have made different decisions as a result of how the universe operated. He had an infinite number of potential universes to select from, and he selected one where the majority of the people to ever live would end up going to hell.
Knowledge does not imply causation.
No, but being the literal fucking cause of everything kinda does.
A mother putting her baby down at night knows that sometime during the night that baby's going to wake up and want to eat. But her knowing that doesn't mean she's causing it to happen.
Unless she's also the person who created the baby and had the ability to make adjustments during the creative process that would affect things like temperament and ability to sleep through the night. Well, a young enough baby actually does physically need food in the middle of the night, so I guess for that fix to work, she'd also have to be the idiot who designed human babies to not be able to sleep through the night right away. What a great design decision that was.
Yes, God could have created a universe where nobody existed, just a dead universe. He could have created no universe. He could have created a universe of robots, but that wouldn't be similar to ours either. If he creates a universe of free creatures, then he has to allow free creatures to be free if he wants free creatures. He just can't decide what to do with them, because then, therefore, they wouldn't be free.
So why does he want free creatures? I mean, realistically, there's nothing in the Bible about free will except for the times that God explicitly violates it, but there's also nothing explaining why God would want free creatures instead of robots, or why the angels didn't satisfy God's need for creatures with free will, given that Satan apparently exerted his free will to disobey God. Why would a universe where he ends up torturing a bunch of people be preferable to a universe where everybody behaves how he wants them to, and so nobody has free will but everybody goes to heaven? I mean, sure, I prefer to have free will, but to be honest, I'm not even sure that I actually do. It is entirely possible that the universe and everything in it is completely deterministic by nature, and so everything that I do is a direct result of the initial state of the universe, and my perception of free will is an illusion. It's also possible that this is not the case, that there's enough randomness in the system to allow for free agents, and so free will is not an illusion. So, quite frankly, Frank, until you can even demonstrate that free will exists, and then explain why God thinks torturing a bunch of free agents is preferable to providing a bunch of non-free agents with paradise, your solution to this question remains nothing but an assertion. And even then, we're still left with the problem that you haven't even addressed the crux of the question. You've just deflected onto other arguments that are, at best, tangentially related.
God can't create a universe, at least not an achievable universe, it seems, where everyone believes. Because, again, if people have freedom, they can choose not to believe. And that's the universe he seems to have created.
And so we run right back around to the problem of the initial question. He knows who will freely choose to believe and who will freely choose not to believe. And he decides who gets created. So he could just decide to not create those who would not choose to believe. You have not answered this question. You have tried to distract from your lack of an answer by answering questions that were not asked, but you haven't even touched on any potential answer to the initial question.
Also, when you say, why doesn't God create people that he knew would go to hell, or why did God create people he knew would go to hell? I think what people are missing when they think about that question is they might not realize that everything is connected, that there is a ripple effect.
Quite the contrary, that is at the crux of the question. Everything is connected, God can see all the connections, knows what the results of certain people being in certain places at certain times to have certain interactions will be, and so could, if he chose, only make the people for whom the sum total of these interactions and connections would be a free choice of belief. Unless you don't think God is powerful enough to keep track of such a complex network. So once again, we're back at the solution for this problem being to put limits on God's abilities.
That if you're listening to me right now and you're a believer, you wouldn't even be alive without atheists. You say, well, how can that be, Frank? Well, I'm sure there are atheists or at least non-Christians in your bloodline, right? You wouldn't even be here without them.
I have a feeling this is going to get to the stage where Frank claims that the purpose of unbelievers who end up in hell is to have an impact that will result in some people ending up in heaven. Which means that every time God creates someone that he knows will go to hell, he is choosing to love one person more than the person who goes to hell. So God's love is a conditional love where he plays favorites.
Dawkins writes the book, a Christian picks it up and reads it and goes, oh, I hadn't heard that argument against God. And it causes the Christian to study more, to learn more about God as a result of what Richard Dawkins has written. So here's a case where an atheist is doing what he wants to do, and it actually causes a Christian to become closer to God.
Yep, there we are. God is playing favorites. He used Dawkins to make someone else believe in him better. So in this analogy, the Christian was already a Christian to begin with, so presumably was already going to heaven. So God made someone specifically to go to hell in order that someone who was going to heaven with or without the hellbound person's existence could go to heaven better? You see how this makes God the bad guy, right?
There are trillions of events that happened before you ever took your first breath. Trillions of ripples that came forward to bring you to where you are now. And God, being outside of time, knows where all those ripples go and what they do.
And there we are. God does see all the connections and knows all the results of those connections, and so could, if he wanted, only make the people whose ripples will have the results that he wants. The only way to make your argument work here is to take away God's knowledge of the ripples. A Ripley God is a bad God.
In fact, God guarantees that to those that love God and are called according to his purpose, that all things will work together for good. All things will work together for good. Notice he doesn't say all things are good. He says all things will work together for good.
Okay, so God's guarantee is worthless since there are people who used to believe in him that no longer do. Of course, I know Frank is a Romans 1:20 style Christian where anyone who stops believing obviously wasn't a true Christian to begin with. But that is a lazy cop-out. I truly believed when I was a Christian. You can tell everyone else that I didn't if you like, but I know that I did. So you telling me that I did not just goes to show me that the Bible is wrong when it says that. And to anyone who has lost their faith, that sort of argumentation will only serve to push them further away.
Yes, God creates people he knows are going to go to hell, but they're freely going to hell on their own. And what they do actually all fits into God's plan.
Well, then God's plan is fucking gross.
There's one other thing that I think this moral objection brings up, and that is it assumes that you could compare something with nothing. Like when they say, well, or Dan asked the question, wouldn't someone have been better off if they hadn't been created? Well, you can't really make that comparison. You're already thinking in your head, oh, wait a minute. Doesn't Jesus say that it would have been better if Judas had never been born? Yeah, he does say that. But Jesus isn't making a philosophical point there. What he's doing is he's using hyperbole to communicate the gravity of Judas's sin.
Couple things here. For starters, we can absolutely compare not existing to existing and say that one is better. I am quite happy that I did not exist in a time when we didn't know what germs were, and so the guy cutting people's hair would then use the same tools he'd cut hair with to perform surgery without washing them. I prefer having not existed then to existing then. I am happy that I did not exist in a time when there would be a guy who owns the land I live on because the king said so, where he could, at any moment, press me into military service so that I could fight a guy that he doesn't like for whatever reason. Non-existence in that time period is what I prefer. And doom and gloom of the current state of the world aside, humanity has always generally tended toward getting better. So assuming that this trend continues, it is entirely possible that, if I were to somehow gain knowledge of a distant future, I would prefer that I lived then instead of when I do live. In other words, I would prefer current non-existence in order to instead exist at a later time. But also, it's quite convenient that Jesus meant something hyperbolically when it suits your purposes. I suppose the verse in Ecclesiastes is also hyperbole then? Why? Why do these two verses just get dismissed as exaggeration?
He was not literally making a philosophical comparison to say that non-existence is better than existence.
No, he was literally just saying that non-existence is preferable to existence in hell. Since that is presumably where Judas would go, even though the salvation of all the Christians since then kinda hinged on his actions. It's really weird that he would get punished for fulfilling the key part of God's plan.
Existing and going to hell cannot be compared with not existing.
Why not? There are whole chapters of human existence that I can say, with certainty, that I know what it was like to not exist during those times, and it is preferable to having existed then. Why could the same not also apply to hell? Given the choice between a blank eternal void of nothingness of which I'm not even aware, and eternal conscious torture, I'll take the first option, thanks.
Because not existing is nothing. I mean, you can compare apples and oranges, they're both fruit, but you can't compare apples to nothing.
An apple is red. Well, the red ones are. Nothing is not. An apple contains sugar. Nothing does not. An apple grows on a tree. Nothing does not. There. I compared them. Now, I think there's only one more thing he says that I want to cover right now, so let's just skip to that.
Remember, there's only three things you can get in life, and there's only three things you can get in eternity. You can get justice, which is getting what you deserve. You can get mercy, which is not getting what you deserve. Or you can get grace, which is getting what you don't deserve.
I'd just like to point out that grace, by this definition, is literally the opposite of justice. And Frank pointed out earlier that God's nature is justice, so God is incapable of doing what is not just. So I guess nobody goes to heaven because that would be against God's nature. That's it for this one. Gonna skip the comment of the day as this video is already pretty lengthy, so thanks for watching, thanks to this week's PayPal hero Ian, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Clench Eastwood, Mark McManus, Mark Ketchum, and all the rest, who are the distractions from the question that is my channel. If you'd like to help me avoid answering things, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is where you'll also find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!